RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
I have travelled to Bristol to visit Aardman Animation, here at their impressive purpose-built HQ. This is also the base of Nick Park, Britain's most celebrated animator, with 4 Oscars, 5 BAFTAs, a CBE and an RDI to his name. He is, of course, responsible for the creation of what has become a national treasure. Wallace and Gromit are the country's best-loved characters. They've even graced our postage stamps. For Park, it has been a long journey that started as a teenager in Preston, where as a shy, solitary boy, he would while away the hours creating flickbook animations using his mother's 8mm camera. Little did he know that that act would propel him into the stratosphere of the film world. In this candid interview, Nick Park talks about his approach to filmmaking, his view on big-budget Hollywood productions, and the increasing use of digital animation. But I started with a question about where his creativity came from all those years ago.
From being very young, my parents encouraged us all to be creative. We're all good at making things, and my oldest two brothers have more gone into, one into, he's more of a scientist and geologist, and another more practical into electrician and plumber. And I've got a sister who's very creative, who does a lot of painting and batik. And my youngest brother is very creative with the woodwork, as my dad was as well.
Yes, I think your father was a very practical man. And I think that's... it's said that, you know, your character, Wallace, is kind of perhaps loosely based on your father anyway.
Yeah. I've only come to realise that in retrospect, really, that I didn't consciously base it on Wallace, on him, but... It was after making a grande out about this guy who builds a rocket, and the way it has this little home from home inside the rocket, you know, comfy chairs and wallpaper. And it was when I was completing that film, it just reminded me of my dad building this caravan from scratch. My mum helped as well, and they did up the interior, so it was a little home from home. I just suddenly thought, this is the rocket, this is... I've somehow taken this from my dad and from my parents.
What was the sort of progress from secondary school?
Yeah, well, from about 13, I mean, I was drawing from very young, really. But I didn't really know it was going to be clay animation, and I just experimented with all sorts. It just reminded me, actually, there was a Bob Godfrey, who sadly passed away recently.
Yes, he did.
He presented a programme, which was on in about 1974 or 75, which unheard of, really. It was a TV programme that was on Sunday mornings, How to Make Your Own. It was the do-it-yourself film animation show. And at the time, no one knew about animation. You know, it was all cartoons. So to have such a specialist programme on BBC...
Yes.
And so I used to watch this avidly, but I always thought... And it influenced what I was doing. And I always thought that this would be a hobby for me. You know, that it was like... I loved the attention it gave me, because I was a very quiet and invisible kind of person, really. And my friends talked about it, and the school talked about it, and I showed my films at school. It was my mum and dad said, why don't you do an art foundation course? And so I did. But even on that course, I didn't think that my animation that I did at home, because it was fun and about humour, and I thought that's not art, because it's not painting and sculpture and, you know, stained glass and all the things we were doing on Pandey, life drawing. It was very much a hobby, and I didn't even tell my tutors that I did animation until my friends told them, basically, on the course. And this is near the end of the course, and they were, why didn't you tell us? That's amazing. And, you know, we've never met anyone who does animation. Sort of, they were very encouraging suddenly, and we made a little film towards the end of the course. And my dad said then, why don't you apply for a BA Honours in filmmaking and animation? And that was, even then, was to me beyond, I think, because coming from Preston, it was, people just didn't go into the film business or TV even. It was kind of not a real consideration for some reason, and in my mind particularly anyway.
Yeah.
So that blew me away, really, and I did. And I applied to the greatest college at the time, was West Surrey. Was Farnham, West Surrey College of Art and Design. And I applied there, but I couldn't afford the train fare to get there. So I went to Sheffield, Sheffield Polytechnic, and I loved it there. So that's where I went.
And what did you do there? You were able to do animation at Sheffield?
Yeah, it was a film course that had animation equipment.
Right.
They didn't get many animators, but people dabbled in it, and so the tutors were very open, a very free kind of course, freely structured, and they let me kind of indulge in animation for the whole 3 years, apart from bits of live action, kind of crash courses in filming and editing and stuff, which was very useful.
And so obviously your passion developed there. That followed on to the National Film and Television School.
That's right. Yeah, at art school I experimented with chalk on blackboard and more experimental, and some puppet animation and a bit of drawn on. And my tutor there, Barry Callahan and Paul Hayward, they said, why don't you apply to the National Film and TV School, and which I did and got in. And they were looking for more animators at the time.
Was it a big shock to you?
It was, because it was such an exclusive place. And there were people from Sheffield who'd got in before. There was some animators who went before me from Sheffield called Derek Hayes and Phil Austin, and they'd applied there and been there, and they set up the animation unit, really. So I was following in their footsteps.
Having had 3 years at Sheffield Polytechnic, you obviously were relatively well-versed in the basics of animation. Mm. So how quickly did you settle into wanting to make your first major short film?
I mean, at the National Film and TV School, they were just setting up their animation department, and in the first year you had to kind of do all these different sort of crash courses in documentary making and filmmaking and film studies and editing, and that was all really quite good stuff to know, actually.
So did they get involved? You got involved with the various crafts, cinematography?
Absolutely.
Really? So they don't sort of...
Yes.
Well, that's very
lighting,
good. That obviously makes a...
Yeah, all the crafts, sound recording, lighting, sound mixing. So it was great to have all that knowledge, really.
Yes.
And in the second, it was a 3-year course back then.
Right.
And towards the end of the first year, I was looking for what would be my project that I would do for the rest of being animation. There wasn't going to be time to do more than one, really.
Mm.
And I was toying with all sorts of animation, and just thought I'd do some tests in plasticine, you know, using clay. It was with Gromit and Wallace. They still exist somewhere, these tests. I remember just moving the eyebrows and how that sort of wowed people, really.
I turned up a guy called Joseph Sund. Have you ever heard of Joseph Sund?
No.
Who made a film in 1926 called Penwiper and Greener Pastures, which is a really extraordinary little film, all made of clay.
No.
And then another guy called Art Clokey.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yes.
Art Clokey.
Gumby.
That's right, 1953.
Gumby and Pokey. Yeah.
Very interesting to see that. And, of course, I think much later when you left... Exactly at the same time that you were, I think, making Creature Comforts, or around about that time, a Pingu appeared.
Tell me about
A Grand Day Out, because that really was the most pivotal thing for you at that time. It was a long gestation period, wasn't it?
It was. I think being, say, you know, the film school... wasn't really, it was just setting up for animation, and I don't think anyone had at that time an idea of how long animation would take. So there was a small bunch of us there, especially with puppet animation or clay animation. So I sort of bit off too much, really. I had a script that was about 20 pages, but it was going to take me another 9 years to make, and I didn't know that. I just set out. I remember it took me a year and a half to film. It was Wallace and Gromit building the rocket. It took me a year and a half to film it, and that was a paragraph in the script that said, Wallace and Gromit now build their rockets.
It is a very painstaking area, isn't it?
And it was obviously going to take me forever to do, and it was. I had bits of help in the lighting and model making, but I was pretty much single-handed with it. And then I knew of Peter Lord and David Sproxton. They'd been heroes of mine for quite a few years. I used to watch Morph on the TV.
Of course, yes, which had been going since 1971, I think.
Yeah.
Long time ago.
And they'd also done some stuff for the BBC and Channel 4 using conversations.
Mm-hmm.
It was the talk of the art school,
right?
Really. And so there was money to get people in to give a talk. And so I asked through a friend, I managed to contact them, and they came in and talked about their work, and they happened to see some of the work I was doing. And so in the summer I got a phone call from them to say, could you, in 1983 I think it was, come and work for us, help on Morph and things like that. So I needed the money. I was a student, and costs, and it was the perfect summer job to have.
So you came down here? Were they still based? They were based in Bristol.
Yeah, they were in a little. It was a. There was editing and all sorts in the same building, top of St Michael's Hill in Bristol. It was very small compared to this, and room for kind of one set to be filmed at a time, sort of thing. But that was great. There was only two or three people here then.
Really?
I did that for about a month and then came back again the next summer. And they kept saying, why don't you come and work for us full-time?
Right.
Which was crazy, really, because I thought, if I do, I'll never finish my own work and I'll be an assistant animator for the rest of my life or something. They respected that, but eventually I ran out of time at the school, and the film school used to then turn a blind eye and let students just carry on till they finished projects. And but I had no money, and they eventually said, why don't we help you make your film, bring it to Bristol, work for us part-time, and we'll help you finish your film part-time. And that was the best of both worlds, really.
And actually, at that time, when you were working here in Bristol for Aardman, you worked on Peter Gabriel's video for Sledgehammer, which is very well known. But what I was amazed to discover is that you actually animated the oven-ready chicken sequence. And the brothers Quay did the claymation sequence, which I found very interesting because, you know, your sequence, which is these little chickens dancing in front of a dark curtain, reminded me very much of sort of David Lynch.
Yes.
And to a certain extent, the kind of sinister quality that the brothers Quay have. Mm. And it was seemed far removed from, you know, the sort of Nick Park we know, the sort of, you know, rather charming. Was that simply because it was a job and that's what you were told to do?
It was, really. I mean, at that time, I was doing a grand day out in one corner of the studio.
Right.
And then I was working on commercials and all sorts part-time. And, yeah, I was part of a group of people. I was a jobbing animator there.
Right.
And was given that task. Yeah, there was a whole... There was another company who were next door to us, David Anderson's company as well.
Right.
And the Brothers Quay, and they all did... They did more of the kind of object animation, really, of fish and fruit and going into Peter Gabriel's head.
Yes.
But it was a great break for us because we were at the time wanting to branch out and experiment more. And,
yes.
And along came Peter Gabriel and the director Steve Johnson. Emily Aardman were part of a group, and there was about 12 or others all doing different things in different parts of the studio.
You completed Grand Day Out, that was nominated for an Oscar along with a lot of other accolades. Mm. But I'm interested in the Creature Comfort series, because of the kind of unscripted, non-actor participation, which ended up creating such a sort of wonderful series, which is full of humanity and charm and also incredibly funny. And that ultimately, I think, won you your first Oscar.
Were you
doing that sort of... Because I think they were both nominated at the same time, so you must have... Yes. Been doing that as well.
It was a crazy time, really, because, as you know, I'd spent 7 years on a grand day out, much of it part-time. On at that point, 1989, there was a group of us, different directors in the company. You know, Peter Lord was one of them, Barry Purvis, Richard Goloshowski, and we were thinking, how can we approach Channel 4 for some money to make a little series, and the only thing we could think we had in common was to carry on what Pete and Dave had already done with found conversation, recorded conversation like this with members of the public. And so we got these different ideas together, and mine just happened to be doing what Pete and Dave had already done, but this time with animals. My idea was to go to the zoo and hear what people say about the animals, but then reverse it and put those words into the mouths of the animals rather than the people, so that it's the animals talking about the people.
Mm.
And it didn't quite work like that. It was really hard. It was really hard to get anything really that good for different reasons.
Although you had that wonderful, I think, was it a lion, talking about wanting more space.
Yes.
Which worked so well.
Yeah, well, eventually I had to forget recording in the zoo and rather just go up to people and say, what do you think about zoos and how would you like it? But I wanted it... They were talking about the animals in the zoo separate to them, and I wanted it, how do they feel about where they live? And so I went, this Brazilian guy who I knew him vaguely already, and he had a very small flat and he hated living in Britain. So I thought, perfect candidate, and I went to kind of old people's homes and places like that.
The Brazilian guy you're talking about, did he see the film eventually? And
I think he left before I finished the film.
Oh, really?
I wonder whether he
has ever recognised his voice. Yes.
Well, I heard through a contact of his that he did know the film, and I think he's a geologist that goes to conferences and he's always asked to do the Jaguar and say space with his hands in the air.
Well, that got you your first Oscar, Creature Comforts, which I've heard you talk about the event, but I'm still going to ask you again. You know, that feeling of winning an Oscar, I mean, you have four, which is an amazing achievement, but that first occasion... Or I think you didn't even have a tie.
No, I didn't.
Because you didn't think you were going to win.
I didn't take a tie. No, it was crazy time, really, because I came from... I mean, Aardman had a great pedigree and behind them, but I came from nowhere. Suddenly I had two films that were nominated and made Creature Comforts in the final 3 months of making Grand Day Out. I was just waiting for the mixing studio to become free at the film school for a Grand Day Out, and in that time made Creature Comforts. So suddenly had two, and Creature Comforts kind of grabbed all the attention, because it won the Oscar, kind of grabbed all the attention, and so Wallace and Gromit were kind of on the back, you know, out of the limelight, really, for a long time.
So what's the feeling when they say, and the Oscar goes to?
Well, I mean, you feel, as a young, very inexperienced animator, I'd never been to LA before, and to go to the Oscars in the heart of Hollywood and thinking... I moved plasticine around. And there's Dustin Hoffman and Sophia Loren, you know, walking past. So you feel completely. I felt completely out of place, and because working with animation isn't a glamorous thing at all. I don't think filmmaking is glamorous anyway, to be honest. Mm. The Oscars is quite kind of separate, to the real business of filmmaking.
After making A Grand Day, you obviously then went on to produce more Wallace and Gromit, the ones we all know. Looking at the first film, Grand Day Out, and then the others that have followed, you can see the sophistication that has followed in everything. The lighting. I mean, the lighting particularly, I think, is extraordinary, really, because it's shot very much like a feature film, very seriously, so many animated films previous to that had proper sets and backdrops. Quite brightly lit, but you got a lot of atmosphere into those sets, particularly the sinister penguin character.
Great team involved, as well, Tristan Oliver and Dave Alex Ridette and Steve Box animating the penguin.
Is that because you were able to get a much bigger... Films are a collective, they're a collaborative thing, and you have your cinematographer and you have your... your set designer and your costume. Does it work that way with you have all of those departments you select yourself as the director?
Definitely. It's like making a film, but in miniature. In a way, that's what I love about it, really, is that you are making a movie, but your characters, the penguin is 3 inches high, 4 inches high.
And they don't demand Winnebagoes and, special...
refused to come out of the trailer.
I was going to talk a little bit about actors, working with that, because it's a sort of an interesting era. I mean, obviously when you started, the actor that we all know, that is the voice of Wallace, Peter Sellers, you just had one actor to deal with. But a little later, once you got into a larger... much larger productions, you had an array of actors: Mel Gibson, Timothy Spall, Miranda Richardson, Ralph Fiennes, Helena Bonham Carter, etc. How is it working on that larger scale as a director working with those? And how does it work directing a voice artist? Do you stand with them and say, more emphasis on that word, or articulate more? How does it work with you?
Yeah, well, I think I'm probably guilty of treating it very much like the animation, really, and it's very, very... finicky and fussy about everything. But I actually don't even like talking over the headphones and the microphone to them, because I like to get in there with them and be able to talk and
is it voiced first?
Well, the voice is first, yeah, because then the animator can work to the voice, and that's broken down into frames. So if a character's in the middle of a long sentence, as an animator, you're thinking, how can I keep the audience entertained here, you know, while they're chatting away? Maybe you even emphasise the fact that it's a bit of a long sentence and have them tapping their fingers, or a background character getting bored.
When you are producing, I take it, are you still very hands-on with animation, or are you more directing these days and others are doing the thumbprint?
I'm more directing.
Yeah.
And it's because the bigger the production gets, the more you've got to do it at more speed and with more money involved.
And the more hands you've got.
So I direct more animators, character design though, and making the originals.
I noticed that on looking at the credits for A Grand Day Out, I think, although there are a lot of people to thank, and there are obviously people that put money in and you thank them, but I think the basic production credits were down to more or less about 16 people on that film.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas on Chicken Run, it was in excess of 326.
Right.
So it's a much bigger... And then there were a whole load of people to thank as well.
Yeah.
And I know that working on these larger productions had its own problems, which have been written about, you know, the collaboration. Do you ever sort of think, well, I prefer those more intimate days when it was just me and Peter Sellers and a couple of friends?
Yeah, I mean, you always long for that simplicity. And but, you know, you also forget how, you know, as soon as we started making, you know, films with a proper budget and proper, you know, even Wrong Trousers, which had a crew of about, I think there were about 8 or 12 of us actually on the floor, but... Two or three of us animating the whole thing.
Yeah.
But the pressure was enormous then to get it done on time and for the budget. It's easy to have rosy glasses about what
past.
It used to be.
Yes.
But I do. Yes. Part of me longs for smallness again, and also I love doing the feature films. There's something really satisfying about having overall creative control over everything, but at the same time. What I love, I think the main thing is that with shorter films, you can get ideas out quicker and move on. And it's hard on a feature film to, you know, you think of a joke and 4 years later you see it on the screen.
Yes, a bit like an architect, in fact.
Right, yeah.
Because they're conceiving something on paper and it's 4 or 5 years or even longer before...
Yes. Yeah.
You know, the shard goes up or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, so it's as painstaking as that. Really, you're known for working with. I think you'd be referred to as the Walt Disney of claymation, quite rightly. Have you ever had the inkling yourself to switch over to digital? I know that Aardman have produced a couple of big all digital films. Does that interest you? And I'm sure that there are digital interventions within your own films for practical reasons, but generally it's clay, isn't it?
Yes.
It's good old clay.
Yes, and I tend to be in favour of the clay myself. Although, you know, like you say, we've ventured into digital for many years now, actually. I'm not a purist about it, really, but I think for me, I look back at how... I think a lot of the humour and the sensibility, that there's a lot that comes from it being clay that's actually more important. It's not just I think the script is all important and the story.
Sure.
But I think just to think you can then do that any old way is the clay has got something to do with it.
Is it something about the sort of imperfection or the... Because often with digitally animated films, they are unbelievably, I mean, fur and hair, all sorts of, you know, intricate things can be, are just so... Mm. I mean, I'd recently seen The Life of Pi and I was stunned to discover that the tiger was virtually completely, you know, CGI. I couldn't believe it because it is so... It's got to a point now where will they need actors anymore?
Yes.
Will they be, you know,
it,
almost as you've got your character, you know, Wallace and Gromit, and they don't answer back and they don't demand this. You could almost create digital film stars and they wouldn't, they'll just do what they're told.
I know, I agree, really. I there's something about showing the vulnerability or the fact that it is just clay, you know, it's a feat of clay.
Yeah.
I think there's something that you perceive. It's like using real instruments rather than, I don't know what it is that's more attractive. And I don't know whether somebody was telling me about the Michelangelo statue that was so beautiful in St. Peter's in Rome, you know, of the Mary holding the Christ, you know, the dead Christ, saying that it was so beautiful. Michelangelo thought it was so beautiful, it was unapproachable.
Right.
And I wondered if there's something. I saw a trailer. I think it was for Tangled. It was for the trailer for the second one. And it was so perfect. Maybe I shouldn't talk about a specific film.
I think I know what you're saying. Yeah. I mean, I've worked with perfectionists. Mm. And there's something about working something to such an extent, it becomes dead.
Mm.
It loses,
yes.
You know, sense of humanity, yeah. Or the frailties.
Yes.
And maybe those clay characters have got that vulnerability. I mean, you can see the thumbprint. You can literally see the little dents.
Yes.
And I know that can be replicated on digitally, but it's not quite the same.
No.
Is it? There's something human.
And I think it's a tricky tension, actually, as well, thinking about it, that is because, you know, you could see clay animation that actually looks a bit ropey and a bit rubbish. Because as an artist, you are trying to push the medium you're working in, to push it beyond itself and to get something out. At the same time, you have to have a humility towards the medium as well. And it's that balance, you know, where you can't let the medium be fully in control you, but you've got to let it be itself as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of...
You've won 4 Oscars, as I mentioned earlier, and a lorry load of BAFTAs and many other accolades, including Royal Designer for Industry and the CBE. Is there anything you have your sights on that you
There's nothing left. There's nothing left.
A lot of pressure on you.
No, I never had my sights on those, really. I mean, you know, it's great. It has been great to be nominated and to actually win as well. And I don't know, I don't think there is. I mean,
you must be the most awarded animator. I think John Lasseter is. Is he behind you?
I
think he's 3. I'm not sure, but I think he's on the digital side.
Yeah, he's got enough. Got a lot. I don't know how many Oscars. I must say, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about who's got what.
How do you separate work from everyday life, or is it for you there is no difference? You're thinking all the time. Or I'm just interested to know, you know, whether you do switch off. I mean, I did hear you say, I think on Desert Island Discs, you like bird watching. Do you get much time to do that?
Yeah, I do. I'm quite into leisure time. I like golf as well, and all sorts. I mean, I don't go out specifically bird watching much, but I love to just be out in the country. Whether walking or driving or whatever, or pub lunch or whatever. Yeah, it's just, I do, I actually, when by bird watching, I'm not someone who goes around looking for rare birds or anything. I love the birds in the garden.
Yes.
I can sit and watch those and just be as happy as seeing a rare finch or something.
And what about writing? Do you write mostly yourself, or you collaborate with others to, you know, maybe expand an idea? How does that work?
I do. I don't feel that writing's my real forte, actually, though it depends what you mean by write. A lot of my writing is doodling.
I think storylines, you know, maybe just an outline.
Yeah, and I do sit at the computer and I do spend a lot of my day just bashing out ideas, and often not formulated, but they're just some starting point. As the idea progresses, I do tend to like to work with someone as a sounding board, and they usually have a better idea of structure. So I've worked a lot with Bob Baker over the years on Wallace and Gromit, and more recently Mark Burton, who writes gags for Have I Got News for You.
Right,
and we've worked with him a lot here. He was on Chicken Run and Curse of the Weir Rabbit. He's good, great at gags and structure as well, story structure.
And so do you work as a sort of group, you know, firing ideas at one another, or very much alone?
Yeah, Aardman, we're very much a collective, really. We have at least a morning a week, or a couple of days a week, really, where different groups get together and just brainstorm. New ideas come in, we bash it out and kick it around. Quite often until there's nothing left of it.
Now, I know that you can't talk about anything you're working on. Apparently, you're sworn to secrecy. I've been told that already. But
you signed the form.
No, I haven't signed the form. But I won't. Obviously, you know, you can only say what you can say. But is there something coming up that you can't talk about? But are you working on...
Well, we are working on more Wallace and Gromit ideas. We've got Shaun the Sheep series and a Shaun the Sheep movie. Mm. I've had an idea I've been working on with Mark for 2 years now. Can't mention, but it's not Wallace and Gromit. My problem is that I'd love to do Wallace and Gromit till the cows come home, but I also want to get other ideas out there as well, which are vying for attention.
Well, I mean, Wallace and Gromit have become part of really British culture. I mean, they've been on stamps. You know, you see them everywhere. And, you know, everyone finds them very endearing. And I guess, sadly, what happens if Peter Salas is no longer... He has such a distinctive voice. It's going to be very difficult.
He's been wonderful. Ever since I met him, you know, I was at film school when I met him.
Yes, I gather, and you offered him rather a small amount of money, didn't you?
Yeah, I think we had 50 quid then to pay an actor. And he came in and of his own transport and out in Beaconsfield. And I thought he was from Yorkshire. I didn't realise he was home counties. But anyway, yeah, he did it as a favour, really.
And then there was a big gap.
Yeah, it was another 6 years before I wanted him to come back in and do some extra bits.
Had you contacted him in between?
No.
Or was it just a...
No.
What did he say?
He had this story that you know, 6 years later, this person phoned him and it was my voice on the other end saying, I finished it. I don't remember that.
Has he been amazed by the success of it all?
I think he has been, yeah. He has said to me very affectionately how much he's just loved doing it over the years. And I mean, he already had Last of the Summer Wine and,
of course,
and a few other things. But it has made up a lot of his career, you know, now. He's now known for Wallace and it's been wonderful.
Ash and I always ask designers who have, you know, made it and have struggled and done all the things that you've done, is what advice would you give any budding Nick or Nicola Park in this competitive, very competitive age, who want to pursue the career that you've made so successful?
It's always a difficult one. I mean, I think I can only talk from personal experience, really, because I you know, it is a very changing world out there, different to where I started. In that, you know, animation was very much a novelty, I think, back in the 70s. But there's a lot of people now in CGI, and it depends if you want to be an animator or more of a creator. That's the difficult kind of person to find. We find here is the most difficult person is the person who can take an idea and really run with it. There are the people who love to be great animators or storyboard artists or, you know, but the person who can...
So the visionary.
Think, you know, really grasp the characters and think up the gags and have the vision, yes, for the whole thing, for the whole piece.
Yeah.
More like the conductor of the orchestra.
Yeah.
Or the composer of the music, really.
Do you go and see many students? Are you exposed to students' work or young? Or do they just simply apply here and send show reels or whatever?
I find I just don't have time to see everybody. But we have people here who look and filter down people's work, and I do get to see it.
Yeah.
And we're always looking for animators, because a lot of animators, you know, we train and then they go on and go to Pixar or somewhere like that.
Yes.
Or DreamWorks.
I've seen your Blue Peter instructional film about how to make it, which is great.
Mm,
Oh, because I think
I
any.
Seen that.
It's a very short little, you know, 3 minute, 4 minute film telling you the basics of animation. You know, how many frames to take, but, you know, rather to get the movement smooth and all of that.
Yes.
And I think any kid that is interested just needs to watch that film for a little bit, and it will get them going with digital cameras and stop frame.
Yes.
And that. It's a lot easier than when you were in your attic or in the garden with
your
8mm.
Yes.
You know, clicking away and
I didn't have
hoping.
Sound or,
no sound and no playback,
or
nothing.
Or a zoom lens
or
focus.
Yeah.
It was all fixed focus. Yeah, and exposure was was very hit and miss, as you'll see from my early work. And the focus was hit and miss. But yeah, what kids have today now is incredible at the disposal.
And so many of them put stuff up onto YouTube, you know, and films that they've made themselves, which are, you know, quite extraordinary. And they get thousands or millions sometimes of hits. It's incredible the way you can put things out there now. I guess you're not shooting on film at all anymore, are you? You started on film, I would have thought. Your early stuff must have been all film. Was Wallace and Gromit shot on film, 35mm or 16?
We switched over. It was 35mm.
Yeah.
It's funny, I started filming Wallace and Gromit on 16 to start with, and then before I did one shot, the school got in this 35mm camera, so I switched. Yeah, we were shooting up till about 5 years ago on 35mm. on Chicken Run and Curse of the Were-Rabbit, we had the highest number of Mitchell cameras, 35mm Mitchell cameras in Europe.
So that was actually shot on film, Chicken Run.
I
thought that would have been digital by then.
There was a lot of digital work afterwards, you know, like smoke and flames and that kind of thing, as in any movie. But then it was a matter of life and death. We switched to digital, and Shaun the Sheep was already digital for TV then. So now we are fully digital now.
Do you miss the passing of film like so many filmmakers, or do you?
I thought I would. I'd probably do in a way, but it kind of gone away, really. We had to have there was like a teething process we had to go through of adapting to digital, because you have to kind of paint the sets a little bit differently and the colours because of what happens, different vibrations, whatever they're called, you know, different normal colours can look quite fluorescent and ugly at times, so you have to be a bit careful.
Now, I'm finding it very difficult these days when I go to see, even if I go to BAFTA and it's perfect projection, sometimes I get very confused about whether I'm watching film or digital, simply because of what they've done. You know, they can desaturate, they can do all sorts of things, and it's just a little tricky.
But the crazy thing is you're trying to mimic film again.
I know. But there's something about that dancing grain. In a way, it's an unreality, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, digital gives you a reality, like opening a fridge door and seeing everything brightly lit.
And for clay animation as well, we could get away with lots of imperfection before because the film somehow is more forgiving. Like if, say, a light has moved, someone's kicked a light stand in the middle of a shot and you might get a little flick on the light. Before it might have been forgiving, but now everything, you know, the exposure all changes and everything compensates.
And I think now they're shooting on much higher frame rate, aren't they? These very big productions now, these sort of...
Peter Jackson.
Yeah, Peter Jackson, isn't he shooting on a...
I believe, on The Hobbit,
And it's so perfect, apparently, that it's just too much.
Right.
I haven't seen it, but I saw
it at the old frame rate for some reason.
Oh, right, okay.
In the local cinema. And I didn't want any more.
Yeah.
I thought it was... The quality was... That's so all I needed.
I wonder what it's like on double the frame rate.
Because It's a funny old thing. It's like we just want more reality all the time.
Yeah.
This kind of thirst for reality. I remember in the 70s seeing a program about the early digital, early computer animation, and the typical kind of bearded Californian professor was saying the pursuit of reality is a worthy goal. And I was thinking, why? Why is it a worthy goal?
Digital then was very amusing because it was so crude.
Yeah.
It really was. But now it's... Well, we come to the end. I'm looking forward to seeing more of your work and hopefully Wallace and Gromit, which I'm sure is in the background there. And Nick Park, thank you very much.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.